So, we are going to try to talk a little bit about the practice of energy without doing anything. It's a little awkward. I've given this a fair amount of thinking, though, because virya and practicing around virya. Very important to liberating the mind. From my own perspective, and just as I look at my own practice, I think that it's the virya that actually helps liberate us. So if you think about it, we can that sense of generosity and all the paramis we were talking about at the beginning of the year, the generosity, the virtue, renunciation, all of that, wisdom. It's all really things that you kind of stand on. It's things that we stand on in our practice. But virya is what brings practice alive. It's what gives us the willingness to do this even when we see things that aren't necessarily pleasant. So it's what I think that's why I picked that poem, because when I read it, it sort of was like, it's just what life is all about. That when you come back the second time, you think, okay, if I could do it again, I just want to be more into life. I don't want to be so much trying to control life and just live it. And so that is what I think of when I think of virya. So I thought of how could I kind of talk about this in a way that isn't so, it's exertion, but it's not so much doing. And so one way to think about it is we talk about the thinking mind whenever we talk about the mind. Whenever we talk about the mind in practice, we're usually pointing to the thinking mind, the problem child. The thing that's causing us so much trouble is that thinking mind. But there is another aspect to mind, in Tibetan, I guess it's Pali term citta, but they talk about it more in Tibetan practices. But there's another aspect of mind which is quite liberated, quite peaceful. And still, but we don't often talk about that aspect of mind. But in order to get to a liberated or awakened state, it's that part of the mind that's going to take us there. You can see it if you go on a long retreat, or if you go on a retreat and you're sitting. As the retreat progresses, something happens in the mind. Something happens with the mind's ability to be still, to get gathered. And when it gets gathered and it gets still, we feel that as more spaciousness, more aware, more open, more energetic. In fact, the longer you get into the retreat, the less you need to go to sleep. All of our patterns begin to change as we get more and more and more mindful. So more and more and more gathered mind. So a couple of ways I thought we could think about it. But first, I tried to find my favorite quote by Ajahn Mun, and I couldn't find it. So I hate to say it like this. I got this Buddha quote, which is a little different, but it's not the quote I wanted. So it's the quote I have to accept. It is, he said, that mindfulness is useful everywhere. That's really what we're talking about with virya, is the energy that comes from mindfulness. For the mind finds refuge in mindfulness, and mindfulness is its protector. Without mindfulness, there can be no exertion or restraint of the mind. So there's no, it's our virya grows out of our mindfulness. So a way to think about it is, here's a couple examples. I thought maybe this would work. I can remember once reading a really good book. I sat down at about 7 o'clock and I read the entire book till the next day I had to go to work. That effort to read that book is virya. I stayed there through the entire page after page after page after page, even though I was just sitting there for several hours. I was just sitting there, but I was there with it the entire time. So I know you know what it feels like to read something you really enjoy. You're not actually doing, but there is an energy that it takes to read it. Because if we don't enjoy it, say no more. We just go to sleep. That's what we do. We have the book that we don't like next to the bed so we can just start reading that so we can go to sleep. Or if we watch a movie or some TV show that we're really interested in, then we can stay with that TV show, you know, for several hours, depending on what kind of Netflix show you're looking at. You can just watch episode after episode after episode, but when it gets boring, then your ability to stay with it, when you lose your interest in it, your ability to stay with it, that is when we get into sloth and torpor and we are less able to stay with something. So a little sloth and torpor around TV or a book, that may not be a big deal, but sloth and torpor when we're talking about practicing and beginning to see the workings of the mind, it can get in our way. So what we are talking about this month is the energetic interest, the energy around being able to stay with practice. And next month, we're going to talk about how to take that energy and temper it so that it doesn't get too restless, and at the same time it doesn't lose its continuity. So because we're not doing anything, we have to be careful, I think, because we can get into, well, maybe I should say this for my own practice. I have been in what I would consider a deluded loop. It's a loop that the more I practice around something, the more I see in myself behaviors I don't like. And there is an immediate sense that I want to stop that behavior. That's all I have to do. If I stop the behavior, then I will be a better person, basically, is what it is. And so I put all this effort in trying to stop this behavior that I see that I don't like. And that effort to stop the behavior actually doesn't work. What the mind, I think, actually does is pulls the wool over the eyes so that I don't see the behavior anymore. So a good way to explain this is with anger. It's my go-to energy all the time. So that's why I always use aversion, anger. For some of you, it might be greed. It might be the need to get or want that grasping after stuff. And for me, it's always the pushing, the irritation. Or for some of us, it's that kind of confusion. I don't know. I'm not sure. That deluded kind of confused state. But for me, the most of my habitual patterns are around some type of pushing against something I don't like. So if I see something I don't like the meanness that shows up when I don't want something. It's quite quick. If I don't want something, I just get mean. I don't mean to be mean, but I get mean. So when I first started practicing, this idea of being mean seemed wrong. You can't sit and listen to Dhamma talks and be around people and you're like, oh, that meanness is so bad. I need to stop that. So I tried to stop being mean, be nicer, not so mean to people. And I think the only thing that actually happened was that I started being mean to me for thinking about being mean or wanting to be mean, and I could kind of control my behavior, but I didn't really stop the meanness. In some respects, I would even not talk to people, like I would not talk to my sons because I'm trying not to be mean to them. And my oldest boy once told me, I don't know why you think you're not being mean. If you don't talk to me, you're being mean. But you know, it's sort of like I tried to come up with a way to not see my meanness, because that's the problem. I don't want to see it. It feels like something's wrong if I see that part of me. So part of what we're going to talk about tonight is having the ability to see that, and what it takes to begin to see that, and how the actual seeing of that meanness is far more liberating than the trying not to be mean. So the trying not to be mean is the doing. The seeing the meanness is virya. At least that's the way I kind of look at it, right? So virya, in the practicing aspect, you could say it's a part of four, it's four efforts. There's another list that says there's the four right efforts, and those right efforts are guarding against or preventing the arising of unskillful behaviors or unskillful, unskillfulness is what I put here. It's abandoning any unskillfulness that has arisen. It's cultivating or developing skillfulness that has not arisen, and it's sustaining arisen skillfulness. So, another way to think about this depends on your words. Skillfulness may not work well. So, it is, you could also say that people say that it's guarding against or preventing the arising of unwholesome behavior, abandoning unwholesome behavior that has arisen, cultivating or developing wholesome behavior that has not arisen, and once that wholesome behavior arises, then you sustain it or try to maintain it. I have a quote from Joseph Goldstein. He says that it's the truth that liberates us, not our efforts to be free. So the more we connect to the truth of something, the more liberated the mind gets, not the effort that we put in trying to be liberated. So let's start. So we're going to hold this idea that that truth comes from the present moment. It's Sally Armstrong once said it's this aiming and sustaining in the present moment. Aiming and sustaining your awareness in the present moment. If you think about it, when you're reading a good book, watching a good movie, watching TV, you are aiming your attention and sustaining it on that book, on that movie, that TV show. So that's what we're doing with anything that arises. But we're going to look at these four skillful and unskillful things. So thinking about guarding against or preventing the arising of unskillfulness, and I had a hard time because this seems like it should be second, not first. It seems like we should deal with the stuff that's already there first and then get to the trying to not have it come back. But actually, it's when you think about it, there is a reason why I would get mean and reactive every time something would happen I didn't like. There's a reason for that. It doesn't just show up out of the blue. There is conditioning. There's habitual expectation. There's a nature that is showing up, and all of those conditions are all around me. But I don't see the conditioning. I just see the meanness. And so you can see, if I just see the meanness, that's what I want to get rid of, because that is what I think is the problem. I don't really notice all the stuff that's generated that actually brings that meanness into play. So this blessing that we have with the practice is that I have ample opportunities to see my meanness all the time. It's always there. The more we sit and be still, the more we're going to see not our goodness, the more we're going to see where we are suffering. We are not going to see our goodness so much. We are going to see where we are causing harm. And it's important to understand that, because if you think that the more you practice, the more you see your goodness, then as you start seeing all this unpleasantness and you see this rubbing and irritation and you see this behavior that you don't necessarily want to see, we're not going to look at it. We're just going to tuck it away, try to control ourselves so we don't act like, you know, like my mother used to say, like, act like we don't have no home training. So we go around and try to pretend like we got home training, but we don't. We're really quite messed up, but we won't see that. And because we won't see it, then we just sort of live in a pretend world. But this practice is about constantly showing us where our conditioning is showing up. So when we start seeing this conditioning, I think ultimately this preventing or guarding, this kind of guarding against the arising of unskillful behavior is really guarding our sense doors. It's Anya's practice, and we know there is a consciousness associated with our sense doors, our ears and our eyes and our felt sense and smells, taste. There are these consciousness that arise with it. So some, probably the best way I can explain it is I grew up in a house where meanness was okay. Can you get this? I grew up in a house where my parents were mean all the time. It was okay for them to be mean to kids. A lot of black parents are mean to their kids, you know? They tell you to sit down, you sit down, that's it. You don't really talk back, you can't say nothing. It was very specific, you know? And I grew up in that world. So when I started actually noticing my meanness and the conditioning around it, it made sense. Of course I'm mean to my kids, because that's what a good parent would do, would, you know, get after them and put these rules up. And, you know, my mother never explained anything. She would just say, because I said so, and that was it. There was no real discussion about why you had to do something she said. And I don't think she thought I'm being mean. She thought she's being a good mom. That's what a mom's supposed to do, is because I said so. So you can see that this conditioning, what starts out as a conditioning, when I start practicing, I start seeing that that is a harmful way of being. So I don't want to do that. But if I don't see the conditioning behind it, then I keep getting distracted by what I see. I keep getting distracted by the seeing and trying to stop that, instead of holding steady with some interest in what I see so that I could begin to see the conditioning behind it. And that's what Joseph's pointing to, that it's the truth that liberates us, not our efforts. Sharon Salzberg said, equanimity's strength derives from a combination of understanding and trust. It is based on understanding that the conflict and frustration we feel when we can't control the world doesn't come from our inability to do so. So it doesn't come from our inability to control the world. Rather, it comes from the fact that we are trying to control the uncontrollable. So in that respect, my meanness doesn't come from Tuareg, she's so mean. It comes from the conditioning of growing up in a house where meanness was okay. It may not be okay to me now, but that's where the meanness comes from. And until I can begin to see that it is a conditioning and a habit, then it just keeps going, and I and the mind in its capacity can just pull the wool over my eyes, and I don't have to see it anymore. I don't really liberate the meanness. In one of the readings I read, it said that the effort that we try, when we try to stop doing some habitual behavior, that effort is connected to a doorway. They called it the doorway to ruin. Some Buddhist texts, I tell you, it's like the doorway to ruin. That's what it said. So if we don't pay attention to our conditioning, that conditioning is the doorway to our ruin. So we either pay attention to it or we're going to head into ruin. So basically what this means is this preventing is we're trying to see into the conditioning behind behavior, behind our behavior. What are the conditions? What are the who, what, when, where, and why's, how's that are going on at the time some behavior or some conduct that we don't like is arising? To do that, you have to be willing to stay with the conduct. And so the next effort is abandoning unskillful, the arisen unskillfulness. So this seems kind of strange to me because the abandoning of arisen unskillfulness seems to point to, I should be stopping the behavior. That is the whole point of this, right? So why? I mean, that's a doing, but it is not. Because you are not, so I may be going out on a limb here. I'm just going to tell you what I've learned in my own way of practicing. You are not trying to stop doing that behavior. I know it's counterintuitive to think that if I'm mean, I'm not going to try to stop that meanness. You don't want to be mean, and I'm not advocating we should walk around and try being mean to each other for a little bit. We are mean to each other. That's what I'm trying to say. So if you try to keep stopping the meanness, you don't see where it's coming from. So what you want to do is see the meanness. Just see it and be still with it. What you are abandoning are the three unwholesome roots. That's the unskillfulness. You're abandoning the greed, hatred, and delusion that's pushing that meanness. There is a, when I would see behavior I didn't like, I would have an aversion towards it, and that was driving my trying to get rid of that behavior. But the more I try to get rid of whatever the behavior is I don't like, the less I could see the behavior, and the more the mind could delude me into thinking, oh, we're all good. I'm going to share something with you. So embarrassing. I'm just going to tell you. So sometimes, I'm just going to tell you about my delusion in practice. And I have been practicing for a long, long time. So I would practice and practice and practice, and everything around what I was doing was in practice. And I was going on longer and longer retreats and all of this sense of goodness was around. I could feel this goodness and kindness around me. And so I begin to think, I'm a bodhisattva. That's what I am. I'm a bodhisattva. Not a practicing to be a bodhisattva. I am a bodhisattva. And because I thought I was a bodhisattva, I couldn't see anything negative that I was really doing. I had let go of anger, and I do not have anger now near like I used to, even though I use it as an example all the time. I had all this kindness and caring and generosity. So I am a bodhisattva. There's no question to it. And then a friend moved in with me. Oh my God. My friend moved in. I'm getting irritated all the time, but I'm a bodhisattva, so I want to practice with irritation. That's okay. I'm just living in this world where everything is nice and good and kind. And then one day she said, you know, what is wrong with you? Why do you just complain and complain and complain? And I'm like, what? No, I'm not doing that. I'm good. I think you're just interrupting my practice, is what I think it is. You are getting in the way of me being able to be my true bodhisattva. When in reality, what was happening was I would have so much aversion around not being able to do what I want to do that I would not notice the aversion. I just kept noticing that she is getting in the way of me doing what I want to do. But when she and I finally start talking about this and I begin to see, wait, I have a lot of aversion to all of this. And just so you know, a true bodhisattva would be able to just be with this without having all the aversion. So this aversion is actually preventing me from seeing where it is I'm creating suffering. I hope you can understand that. That's what I'm trying to help you see. When I begin to abandon the aversion, then even my behaviors of irritation would last shorter periods. I could see I was irritated, I could see what was happening, and I could stop the kind of irritation before it causes harm because I could see the damaging nature of it. But when I was so caught in the aversion, I could not see any of the damage I was causing. So what you're abandoning is your resistance or your grasping after something. You're not really doing anything to change the behavior. You're letting go of the pushing against something you don't like seeing or grasping after something you wish you had. That is our unskillful exertion, efforting, that doesn't cause the liberation. When you let go of the aversion, you can begin to see where the mind is grasping or averse, where your irritation is. You can see what's actually happening. And then your ability to discern whether you want to stay on that path or not completely shifts, completely changes. You can see. Ajahn Chah said that a woman wanted to know how to deal with anger. So I should say Tuareg wanted to know, how do you deal with anger? So I asked, when anger arose, whose anger was it? This is what Ajahn Chah asked her. When anger arose, whose anger was it? And she said, it's hers. Well, I said, if it really was her anger, then she should be able to tell it to go away. Shouldn't she? But it really isn't hers to command. Holding on to the anger as a personal possession will cause suffering. If anger really belongs to us, it would have to obey us. If it doesn't belong to us, it means it's only a deception. So don't fall for it. Whenever the mind is happy or sad, don't fall for it. It's all deception. Wow, that's saying something. So basically, what I think he's pointing to is that sometimes in order for us to see what we're actually doing, the underlying kind of tendencies in our happy, sad, irritation, all those emotional states that we then respond to and react to in life, because we are in those emotional states, if we could begin to understand that those emotional states are not ours, then we can begin to step one step back and see the greed. When we are happy, the longing to keep that happiness and stay happy, that greed for it is setting us up for suffering down the line. So we want to begin to try to see into those unwholesome roots. So we're guarding against all this unwholesomeness or this unskillfulness. We're looking at our conditioning. That's how we can guard against its arising, when we begin to understand the nature of the conditioning that's driving it. And then when we see that some unwholesomeness has arisen, then we want to begin to pay attention to the underlying tendencies towards greed and aversion or delusion that's keeping that unwholesome behavior or unskillful behavior alive. We want to abandon that so that we can see the behavior more truly for what it is. The next thing we want to do is cultivate or develop skillfulness that hasn't arisen. I think this is connected to the two wings of the Dhamma. It's sort of cultivating wisdom and compassion. We're cultivating that ability to see wisdom and compassion in any given moment. And the cultivations that they listed in most of all the readings is you're cultivating kindness, you're cultivating non-harm, and you're cultivating generosity and the awareness of the three characteristics of impermanence, dissatisfaction, and emptiness. So you're trying to see in any given moment how do I find kindness or acceptance in a certain moment? When you're irritated, how do you find kindness? I mean, you could just think, well, I'm irritated. But the practice is to cultivate kindness in all moments. So even in moments when you don't feel kind, you look for the friendliness in that moment. Just what would it take for the quality to be kinder or friendlier or soften and accept in this moment? That's what you're looking for. It's really paying attention, as I see it, to our attitude that we bring in whatever relationship we have with something. Another quote from Ajahn Chah is, peace is within oneself to be found in the place as agitation. Oh, I'm sorry. Peace is within oneself to be found in the same place as agitation and suffering. It's not found in the forest or on a hilltop, nor is it given by a teacher. Where you are experiencing suffering, you can also find freedom from that suffering. Trying to run away from suffering is actually running towards it. So what he's pointing to is this idea that in the moment is when you want to cultivate kindness. In fact, I would say, at least for me, the best kindness is what I can find when I'm mad. The best kindness or the best friendliness, the most endearing kind of generosity and goodness is when I find it when I'm irritated. I used to say when I was at work, that I was practicing on being a friendlier prosecutor. That's what I would say. You know, when I would get mad, I'd say, okay, I'm going to start practicing on being a friendlier prosecutor. So that I could somehow or another, I wanted to practice friendliness in a competitive world. And the mind has a way of making friendliness seem weak. But if I were to couch it in this, a friendlier prosecutor, that sounds like a nice thing. That sounds like you're doing a really good job. So everybody liked it. Everybody was like, okay, well, let me give you some space to get friendlier. So that you're looking for a way to cultivate this skillful behavior, not so much in the times that we are being skillful, but in the times we are not being skillful. We're trying to cultivate kindness, cultivate friendliness. And then you can see that in that cultivating the kindness or friendliness in the midst of unskillful behavior, that if you notice that that kindness has arisen or that friendliness has arisen, then you try to hold on to it. If you feel a sense of giving and receiving and generosity, or you can see the nature of impermanence, like this too will pass, then you want to hold that, maintain that sense of awareness of that wisdom or that kindness or that friendliness as long as you can. And then when it goes, it goes. Sharon Salzberg said that the practice of loving kindness is about cultivating love as a transformative strength. So we're transforming some moment. What's really transformative is our willingness to keep going, our openness to possibility, our patience, our effort, our humor, our growing self-knowledge, and the strength that we are gaining as we keep going. So basically, when we're practicing, and you keep practicing around these difficult places, and you're constantly trying to cultivate this skillfulness in the midst of unskillfulness, and then hold that skillfulness when you see it, when you notice that all of a sudden you have softened, when you didn't even, the mind just softened, and you have all this capacity to be with something, or you're irritated, and then you just relax. Or somebody said, I think the first night we first did this talk, that they're sitting there and they have all this aversion, and then there's this kind of acceptance and it just relaxes. That capacity, when you see that, when you observe yourself doing that, you try to hold on to that. We don't just poo-poo it like it's no big deal. It's a big deal. We give it the same degree of attention and awareness and sort of care that we give trying to deal with unskillful behavior. So, in the long run, it's this continuity of mindfulness. It's what we're actually, that's what the virya is doing. That's why it's not really a physical exertion and doing, and if we end up trying to do something, then we end up actually going against our ability to liberate the mind. So I want to see if I can give you an example of this. I have to use a meditation example. I was sitting there meditating, and I know you guys probably don't do this, but I am striving to stay on the breath. On the breath, and I'm striving. And I had set this intention, I'm going to sit a long time, so I'm not getting up. And I kept getting, I just kept stopping. You know, I just, all of a sudden, I'm not meditating. So I went to my teacher to brag about how long I had been sitting, right? And how long the sits were. And so she, Carol Wilson, bless her heart, she looks at me and kind of poo-pooed whatever the time was and said, so why do you stop meditating? I said, I don't know. I just stopped. I told you I was sitting there for like an hour and a half, and you're worried about when I stop? Who cares? And she's like, well, I think it's more interesting if you investigate why you're stopping. I mean, it's done. That's what I thought, you know? So I said, okay. So I'm going to go try to see why I'm stopping. And I... I begin to notice that really what was happening is I would get cold. It's like my energy would begin to wane down. I would get cold. And when I would get cold, I didn't want to sit anymore. I was done. So that's what I told her. I said, well, I get cold. And when I get cold, I don't want to practice anymore. She goes, oh, well, why don't you just generate some more heat? I'm like, maybe I should tell you. I'm like sitting a long time, over an hour. She's like, she doesn't even care. She's like, oh, if you notice that the energy is going down, then generate some more energy back up again. I'm thinking she should say, I think I expected her to say, oh my God, Tori, that's so great and so special. You're doing really, really good. But instead, she just keeps wanting to know, why are you going down? Why are you going up? So I would go back, and now I'm going to try to see if I can generate some more heat. And I could. I just would turn my interest onto the breath or whatever, turn the interest on, generate more heat. And then when I would get too tight, paying attention to the breath, I would relax and soften a little bit. And this kind of, I just begin to notice that the virya is more of right here, right now. So if you think of these four efforts, they kind of all intersect with each other, right? So if you're abandoning arisen unskillfulness, in a way you're also cultivating skillfulness. You're abandoning one thing, but you're cultivating the other. Or if you think of it as you're preventing the arising of unskillfulness, you are at the same time sustaining the arisen skillfulness. Can you see this? But not just that. You're also, when you cultivate this skillful or the rising of wholesome qualities, you are necessarily creating the capacity to sustain that. Because by cultivating the wholesome qualities of generosity, you are getting intimate with what it feels like, and you can sustain it as it comes. Likewise, when you are abandoning these unskillful, you are at the same time learning how to prevent their arising, because you are getting intimate and you understand the nature of where unskillful, unwholesome energy or qualities come from. All of the, even though you're technically just with the mind, you're just, if you see some unskillfulness there, you are trying to abandon the aversion towards it. You're trying to abandon your grasping after something. Or you're trying to abandon that delusion that you're not really mad when you're really mad, right? You're trying to abandon that. And at the same time, when you see it, you are cultivating this wisdom of discernment, this non-harming, this kindness, that softening into it. In any given moment, you can see that if there's this energy that's pushing up against you, you can begin to like soften before it even arises, before the irritation gets too much into anger. You can begin to sense it and feel it right there. So basically, what this is a self-revealing practice. It's not so much about doing anything different. It's an unfolding in a moment of time. It's a way to think about it. You're trying to take the selfing, the self that's doing something, out of the present moment. And so you work with it not by getting caught or involved with what has actually arisen, but more with just trying to keep your awareness that is this that has arisen, is it skillful, is it not skillful? Is it wholesome, is it not wholesome? And trying to then just in one moment work with whichever has arisen or not. Ajahn Sumedho said that the mind of an enlightened human being is flexible and adaptable. The mind of an ignorant person is conditioned and fixed. So this virya, when you're practicing with it, it actually gives you the capacity to be flexible and adaptable. So I want to leave us with a quote from Joseph Goldstein about why we really want to work with all this stuff. He said, ask yourself how many of the billions of inhabitants on this planet have any idea how rare it is to have been born a human being? How many of those who understand the rarity of a human birth ever think of using that chance to practice the Dhamma? How many of those who think of practice actually do? And how many of those who start continue? But once you see the unique opportunity that human life can bring, you will definitely direct all of your energy into reaping its true worth by putting the Dhamma into practice. Okay, so let's just sit a moment. Right. I'll see if there's any questions or comments. Yeah.
So you talked about the difference between seeing the behavior, the behavior that
yes, so the question was, when I talked about seeing the behavior that we don't like, and I was talking about seeing the conditioning around it, we could think about all my past stuff and all the stuff that's happening, but really it's the seeing in the present. It's seeing the conditions that are present right now. And we could see those conditions if we didn't get involved in the behavior and more connected to the felt sense of the sense doors. If we could feel just the sitting there, you can almost feel your family tradition in the body that tells you you should be doing something or tells us we shouldn't be doing something You can almost feel it in the body. That's why I think it's connected to the guarding of the sense doors, is that being still with whatever the behavior is and sensing into what is pushing all this. What is the underlying conditions that are in place that drive something. So I'll give you an example. Almost like clockwork, 9 o'clock, I want something sweet. I'm gonna search my house until I find that if there's no sweet in there, I'm gonna go to the store, which is only like 2 blocks away, so it's very quick and it's open 24 hours. I'm gonna go get something sweet. If I don't pay attention, it happens without even me thinking. If I pay attention, then I could actually begin to just give myself 15 minutes and know that whatever that impulse is, that habit, it's the conditioning. The body knows it's 9 o'clock. I'm not really paying attention to the fact that it's 9 o'clock, but the body knows it's 9 o'clock. And then it says, okay, time for our sweet, time for our dessert. That's what I mean by the conditioning. It may be that it didn't, I don't know how it is connected to family, but the idea is in that moment, 9 o'clock is really a condition precedent to me needing to go get something sweet. That is the only reason why I need something sweet. Because at 8, I don't need it. 10, I don't need it. 9 o'clock, very hard to get past that moment. But I've learned to practice for 15 minutes and then I can tell. So as soon as I start feeling that, oh, I need something sweet, I look at the clock. That's how I know it's at 9 o'clock. So it's sort of like beginning to see that some of this is conditioning, and then you can see the impulse that's pushing behind it. Then you can see, oh, I could go get something to eat, and sometimes I do go get something sweet, but sometimes I don't. But it's more of, I know what's happening because I'm intimately aware of it, right? Yeah, that is a paradox.
So my practice is I train with boxers and occasionally I spar. And the other day I had a really enjoyable sparring match. And my coach asked me why. And I said, well, because I'd really like to get inside and see the other person cower.
Gotta really like that boxing.
Yeah. And I hadn't realized that until I said it. Until she asked me and I said it. And so tonight I was thinking what we're talking about. Well, it's not the purpose of this. I mean, this is my part of my spiritual practice. And my purpose in this is not reach or should not really be to watch the other person cower and enjoy pushing him or her into a corner, letting him do walks, fall. But in the perfection of the practice, where there is no pleasure necessarily, nor is there any disappointment. So it's really interesting to people that
how I get. I guess I'm assuming you're giving that comment about being a friendlier boxer and what. So just so I can kind of synthesize this, you're saying that you're noticing, you noticed yesterday that really you're trying to lean into it and have the other person cower. To me, that is the nature of the practice, is the seeing what it is that you're doing. It's not a right or wrong, so maybe in boxing, that's what you need to be doing. You know, a prosecutor is a little aggressive. The friendlier prosecutor is more for me to have permission to practice in the midst of an otherwise competitive world. It gives me the permission to seek softness and kindness in the middle of a trial. Because then when you get in the trial, you're like boxing, right? You're fighting. And it's not that I'm going to stop fighting. That's not going to happen. But I can fight softer. I don't have to be quite so rude about it. Do you see? I can tone the edges down a little bit. And so it may not necessarily that you stop the need to see the other person cower, but it may stop some of the unnecessary aggression, right? It's that unnecessary aggression. But the boxing itself is going to remain the same. So the fact that you can see that, that is practice. That's what virya does. Helps us stay present to what's actually going on with us when we're in conduct, so we can see that.
So what the coach said was, well, you better enjoy it when it comes back after.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah, that's what I was thinking. Yeah. I know, and we're so proud of you.
I felt really complete in it, and it felt good. And then a couple months after it was published, I discovered the Amazon author page, at which you can track how many sales there are. Mm-hmm. And I know, and what I've realized recently, like I caught myself like going multiple times a day to look at that page. And then all at once I realized, oh, I'm feeling good right now, and in 2 hours, because it just went up, but it goes, it zigzags, and in 2 hours, I'm going to feel bad because it would have gone down.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so the comment is that she just sold a book and she can watch the tracking of the book sales, and so she gets caught in that compulsive behavior of watching the tracking of the book sales. Here's,
and not just that, but feeling good.
Oh, feeling good when it's good, when it's up, and yeah, feeling bad when it's down. So here's my take on it, right? There's two things happening here. The mindfulness is getting lost in the habitual nature of the whole thing. And what you want your virya practice to be around is to be that as a practice. So the mindfulness is not so much, it's sort of like when the energy, I guess the best way to say it is, it has to be a practice, meaning that it has to be that I am going to watch this as a practice. So when it's less about the judgment, about your emotional energies going up or down, you don't want to get caught in that one way or the other, but you want to see what's happening, and you want to look for the wisdom even in what you notice. So you can practice around noticing whatever is arising, right? And I think I would practice one step even further before I get to the computer, what is happening that triggers that impulse to go to the computer. Because I think it's like 9 o'clock. There's something that happens, and then that is what triggers the let me go check the computer. Almost as if I check the computer, then I'm gonna feel better. But then when you check the computer and it's down, then you don't, right? It's disappointing. But I think the impulse is that I'm going to feel better if I go check the computer. So it's more like just taking the time to look at what's going on. And to do that, you can't feel like you need to stop checking the computer. The best example I can give is when I wanted to quit smoking, and I thought, Rodney kept implying that you could just quit smoking. I think he saw me smoking. So he said, you just quit. So I had an argument with him, and I said, you can't just quit smoking. You don't understand. It's a habit. And he said, I don't want you to stop smoking. I just want you to stay with it and don't stop noticing it. The problem with habits is we don't really see them. We know they're there, we know they're happening, and every once in a while we can kind of see it out of the corner of our eye, but we don't really stay with it. And so what he had me do was to stay with the smoking from the moment I had the impulse of wanting to have a cigarette, all the way through till I got it, smoked it, and finished it, put it away, and went back to doing what I was doing. The point was to stay mindful through the entire process. Worst process ever. I mean, the smoking was the worst thing ever. I never really realized how much I hated the process of smoking until I had to stay with it, and it wasn't just an impulse. So if you want to see what's happening, then you sort of have to stay with the behavior and don't try to make the behavior go away, because you're using it as practice to watch what's happening and see what it's doing. Do you see what I'm saying? That's the difference. So that's why you don't want the practice to go away. You want the aversion to that impulse to go to the computer, you want that to go away so you can begin to see what's going on. It'll tell you a lot about what's happening. Probably has nothing to do with the book. Just hint. We better stop so you can do the announcements.